Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Be There in 5 podcast. I'm Kate Kennedy, your host. As I record this, it's not even 48 hours since Taylor Swift released her 11th album, The Tortured Poets Department. And as always, every bait and switch is a work of art, because not only did most of us totally misread the concept of this album as just being a heartbreaking postmortem about Joe, we also should have known that, of course, that during the brief time she was single, you know, in the past 7 years, she was going to write a double album. I mean, we've literally guessed every other album leading up to this would be like a double album. Never happens. Sure enough, we have a 2 a.m. surprise. 15 more songs. 15! There's 31 songs in total, 13 in reverse, obviously. I wasn't going to talk about the album yet this week, especially because my sister and I did a 4-part reaction video on Patreon, so that feels like plenty of commentary coming from me. But part of me was like, well, this is what we're all thinking about. And more importantly, this is what a lot of us aren't sure what we think about. You know, like, and that's okay too. I also think, like, this is just such a vast album in terms of the topics covered, the spectrum of devastation to joy, the use of like injections of humor that we haven't had before, just the sheer volume of songs. And while I feel like I can't provide a quick take or like a singular viewpoint of I love it, I hate it, it's good, it's bad, it's meant to be what it's supposed to be. And if there was ever an album that is not pandering to her audience, it's this one. Like, I think this was made for her. And I think, like, we should keep that in mind as we talk about it, because I think it's perfect as is, because I think it is so distinct. It's clear that this is what she really wanted to make. And whether it was cathartic or experimental, or she kind of was interested in taking her image down a notch because her resentment of her good reputation is just as stark here as she once felt, you know, completely distraught by her bad reputation. The image she's upholding now seems to be the thing that's most in her way. And yeah, there's just so much here. But the volume of songs, the response to that is interesting. And maybe this is the creator in me that also likes to give people more than less and feels surprised when people complain about it. I've been fascinated by some of the formal reviews. Like, The Atlantic said she, you know, has a quality control issue, and the New York Times said she needs an editor. And I think the chaos is the point. Like, this isn't the level-headed Poets Department. But I saw so much commentary that's like, I wish we had time to process the first album. There's too many songs. There's the, like, you have time. I think that because of creators like me, because of the democratization of commentary where everyone's take can be out there now, there can be a sense of overwhelm. I feel like there's this pressure on the casual consumer who's not making content about something to feel like that once something is released, it needs to be binged watched, binge listened to, binge read, you know, and it actually doesn't. Like, it would offend me that people insisted on like snorting this album instead of, you know, savoring it. Like, poetry is compact delivery of complex thoughts. Like, it's meant to be opened. It's meant to be aerated. I sound like a pretentious asshole, but I really do think that, like, the words were the priority and the melodies were maybe secondary. And she was very clear about this being poetry. And I don't think they all make for the best songs, but I'm not sure that was even the intention. Like, I think she was taking a risk, and I think this was a concept album. I don't know. To be clear, it is a lot. And when she announced 15 more songs, if you watch the Patreon, I cried out very dramatically, no, twice. I think I literally cut out the words from the edit. I have a child who needs me, as if I was being held captive, but I'm not. We're not. We can take a breather. I think we should just enjoy something for a minute before we know what I'll do eventually, which is fall down the rabbit hole of like reimagining her catalog, like through the lens of an on and off 10-year romance, where it would have been fun if Maddie Healy was the one. And personally, I'm not emotionally prepared to have some of my favorite songs reinterpreted. If this whole time, like, false god, can you imagine if the false god I've been worshiping for years was actually a pretentious edgelord? That lord I do not want to lift his name on high. I can't talk to you in times like this, literally. So far, I'm really enjoying it. If you like listen to any of my other album recaps, with the exception of Midnight's maybe, it's pretty rare that I'm like over the moon first listen. Like I always have my handful of favorite songs, the ones I need to spend more time with. And then in like 6 weeks, I'm like, oh my God, I get it now. I just am not, it just takes me time to warm up to stuff. Like my favorite movies are ones I've already seen. My favorite songs are ones I've heard a million times. It is 2024 and I am still listening to, on a weekly, if not daily, basis, the song Out of the Woods. And it is quite literally 10 years old. I loved Midnight's because I'm a pop girl, but I also love Melancholia. I love a pensive anthem that's not too clouded with bloated metaphor. Like, I like symbolism and I like analysis, and I was ready to geek out over this. But I will say it's absolutely not what I thought it was going to be. We're not really storytelling. We're like being dropped in hyper-specific scenes using a ton of symbolism for a relationship like we didn't even know was happening majority of the time. And I think that's what's so interesting. It's like highly confessional, deeply personal, is showing a very flawed version of Taylor Swift that she historically hasn't seemed to be as comfortable revealing. But she hinted at this in Dear Reader. And I actually think that like one of my favorite songs of hers of all time is on this album. I'm sure you can guess which one. I'll get into it. I will say the listening experience was just so damn fun. She completely pulled one over on us in so many ways. And, you know, when you think about the lyrics of Dear Reader, it's kind of her setting up, like, don't look up to me. Never take advice from someone who's falling apart. Like, my fourth drink in my hand, death prepares of a cursed man. Like, it's so interesting to think about her setting up an era where she was kind of going to out herself as, get this, a human being with flaws, who makes bad decisions, who doesn't respond perfectly to impossible experiences that humans go through, like grief, like loss. Dear Reader, get out your map, pick somewhere and just run. Florida. Dear Reader, burn all the files. And then in the Fortnite music video, she's burning all the files. She's using a lot of mental health language, like manic and depressed and this, that, or the other, but famously like has never been to therapy. So I'm like, I'm wondering if she actually sought counsel. I'm not trying to get all up in her medical grill, but I'm wondering if we're still in a place of like, you know, in college and I was like, oh my God, I'm so depressed. The au bon pain is out of broccoli cheddar soup. I think most of the songs are like artsy and tortured and intense and take a minute to pick up on, but two track fives are the most immediate clarity. Like they cut through the clutter. They're so deeply heartbreaking. On side A, it's So Long London. Side B, How Did It End? How Did It End is such an interesting example of like so much is wrong and has been for so long and you've let it slide, but there is kind of just one day it all falls and you can't pick the one straw. Unfortunately, in my head right now is Don't Spill the Beans, Don't Break the Ice, Ants in the Pants and Cootie. That board game, is it Break the Ice where you pull out sticks and everything falls? That was, wow, poetry right here. But yeah, I don't know where to start. I need the roadmap, almost like the five stages of grief, but like the five stages of readjusting your expectations after a Taylor Swift album rollout, because I'm just adjusting. I'm adjusting and I'm marinating. And there's like a handful of songs I'm obsessed with right out the gate and a bunch I need to spend more time with. That doesn't mean I don't like them. Even though like I'm not super familiar with the music yet, I just feel like there are some high level things we could talk through if you want to. I haven't even heard all the songs. Like as of now, I haven't listened to Robin, I Hate It Here. I gave one pass to The Manuscript, but I was getting a little confused. And there's like one or two more that I'm like, I just don't. They were starting to run together, and then I was starting to get frustrated because I couldn't distinguish anything, and it was almost like, you know when, like cult leaders inundate you with information and deprive you of sleep till you start speaking a different language, you don't like even know your own name, you're talking to people in a language that you think makes sense, but they don't understand you, they have not been immersed in the world you've been in. I kind of like snapped at Greg Friday as I was so tired about like I was looking for cash because my dry cleaner only takes cash. I don't even, and like I just was so short with them for absolutely no reason. He was like, whoa, I just am like, I'm probably a deranged woman. I'm just carrying all my clothes down the sidewalk, limping, underslept, underfed. People try to talk to me and I just am mumbling lyrics to myself. Like I really felt like a shell of myself yesterday. If you see me on the streets, I'll just be mumbling like, I was gentle, but the circus life made me mean. It's like, what? It's like, well, my mother was a saintly woman, but she used to say she wished her dead. It's like, what are these lyrics? I don't know. A support group might be helpful. So we could go around in a circle, just be like, I'm Kate. You know, I thought it was in for Sylvia Plath. But I am on song two, and what I got was Charlie Puth. You know, we love a man with perfect pitch whose last name is a swing and a miss. My God, someone's going to have to keep their maiden name in that situation. But yeah, not, you know, I was expecting to be taken to the lakes where all the poets went to die. That's what I packed for. But where I ended up was getting fucked up by Florida. A little less Sylvia Plath, a little more Welcome to Plathville. Oh, I'm back in Tallahassee. What am I doing here? Just when I was feeling like the Puth was uncouth. She's like, I'm having his baby. No, I'm not, but you should see your faces. And we took the bait. Kelly and I were confused, then shocked, horrified. I had a full double chin, mouth agape emoji face. And then she was like, you should see your face. And I was like, how did I fall for this? It was awesome, but also gave me that weird feeling like somebody just said it smells like Up Dog in here. And even though you know this better than your knee knows to extend when the doctor bangs it with a mallet, like just you reflexively are like, what's up, dog? And you're like, fuck, you know, you want to think you'll know better. I really do like Badaddy. I love him. I know when she really says the word vipers with a certain level of intensity, it is fun. Interesting to me because it's not a word I hear that often or a word that would like offend me if somebody called me that, because it's almost kind of a cartoonishly tough word. And it makes me think of the guy DJ Tanner dated in Full House named Viper, from that short-lived polka band Jesse was in called Hot Daddy and the Monkey Puppets. That's important that I just shared that. But yeah, it was through shows like that where I learned cues. You know, you wear a leather sleeveless vest and a chain wallet. That means you're bad news. Some of my favorites, which are not going to surprise you guys at all. I really thought So Long London was beautiful, and the way she makes the bell sounds with her voice. But Daddy, I Love Him is the weirdest, wildest song she's ever written, and I'm obsessed. Who's Afraid of Little Old Me is haunting. It has Tears Ricochet vibes. It's like, if I'm dead to you, why are you at the wake? She rose up from the dead because she does it all the time. Comes back as some sort of like rabid zombie, rises up from the gallows and like levitates down your street with no teeth. I mean, truly spooky stuff. I mean, she is a tried and true millennial, and we are a very hocus pocus forward people. And the only thing I can picture is Billy Butcherson, you know, before they realize he's a friendly zombie. He's like, who's like, he has big Who's Afraid of Little Old Me energy. I think he just like want to be laid to rest, but he gets provoked. Also, what a dark story he has. Like, he and Winifred Sanderson kissed one time, and she was so mad about, like, when they were children, and she was so mad about him, quote unquote, cheating. She like poisoned him and sewed his mouth shut. You've got a blank space, I'll whip stitch your face, potato, potato. It's like, I leap from the gallows and levitate down your street, crash the party like a record scratch as I scream. It's like such a visual. I know people don't love using the word crazy, but I feel like this album is like airing out her crazy a bit, and we all have it in us. It's like, I'll defend our emotional responses that I think are unfairly branded as too reactive, but also I've done a lot of things that are actually crazy. But I remember feeling like it was a big statement in All Too Well. It's like now one of my favorite lyrics, because in a song that has such poetic language to describe something, I think it needed a moment where it was like, it made me want to die, just to be like girlish and silly. But I remember thinking that was like, whoa, I kind of can't believe she said that. But I mean, she's really going for it with this fling, with the hyperbolic death commentary. Like in Tortured Poets Department, you told Lucy you'd kill yourself if I ever leave. And I said that to Jack about you, so I felt seen. It's like, oh, we're naming Nate. Like, this is obvious who this is. This is why as fans, we don't know shit, because we're like, oh, well, obviously this is about Joe. given his group chat with Paul Mezcal and Hot Priest as, you know, tortured men's club or whatever. Nope. This is a term reserved for people that bring typewriters to people's apartments like they are laptops, which is tough stuff. The typewriter was missing the number one in the video, which I think vintage typewriters, that happens. Like, because there was an L or something, like they didn't want to use two keys for the same thing. Yeah, and that shot in the Fortnite video, it was like a back where there was a one, and people think the one is about Maddie. And I just think that's interesting, because even if typewriters came that way, maybe that's like the point of kind of showing that. I don't know. I stopped clowning a while back because the circus, you know, made me mean. I Can Do It With a Broken Heart. Bop of All Bops. I'll Never Be the Same. Such a perfect song. Lights, Camera, Bitch, Smile. Her hearing the like ticker count in her ear while she's processing all of this. At the end, the lyrical, I'm miserable, ha ha, are you kidding? Like, that's the best thing that's ever happened to me. Try and come for my job. I love anthems that are like empowering but relatable, because I think some of us just aren't wired to think we are the shit. But I also like wholly believe in my ability to produce and my creativity. I think that I can look really hot, but I also think my face is kind of stupid. We can be both, and I always feel both. And I think Taylor Swift is like an interesting combination of a like confident, empowered woman who knows that she's at the top of her game, paired with like a girl just trying to fill the empty lunch tables of her past. I mean, that isn't that girlhood? We, most of us are all the things. Our inner children are evolved adults. And yeah, it might be one of the best first listens I've ever had, next to like Cruel Summer, Blank Space. I love a song that's like, I'm a confident bitch. I can handle my shit. No, I'm not doing good, but my self-worth is my output. Oh, you want me to make a cake for a coworker's birthday? I have big plans, but I think I'll drop them so I can beg for Dave. You don't need to pay me back. I'll deprioritize my own needs just because you asked. You know, like sometimes you're a strong, independent woman that has trouble saying no to things. Anyway, that song is everything to me and more. The other ones I love are Smallest Man That Ever Lived has a scathing bridge, and I'm here for it. I mean, again, I've like hardly listened to any of the back half. Cassandra is an interesting like nod to Greek mythology and the character Cassandra that like warned people, and she warned people about the Kardashians. I mean, that's pretty scathing in terms of blood being thicker, but they're on the payroll. I mean, wild, wild. Again, this is not a deep dive. You know, Amy confuses me because it's just so on the nose. And like, obviously, clearly we can see Kim is capitalized. Like, what else would it be unless we thought this was, you know, a 1999 screen name? It's just playing fast and loose with upper and lower cases. So the Northwest Bridge, while clever, like a song that only we know is about us, and I've changed the clues. Sometimes I'm like, you think we're smart enough to hear words like calamitous and, you know, mercurial and the difference between elegies and eulogies, like in passing in a song, and like we'll pick up on what all of that means, like inside a metaphor. But you don't think I'll pick up on Kim being capitalized in a song title like that? That's too on the nose. There's no way. So what's probably happening is it's a nod to something else that I'm not, that I'm like too dense to see. But I feel like, yeah, I just don't, this is, maybe I'm different now. I don't like feel like going back through Northwest TikToks. And I genuinely think she was having fun doing the most of this album and not editing it whatsoever, because it's poetry and it's like meant to be kind of haphazard and chaotic. Even though I joke about ruining some of my favorites, I really think I realize that's perhaps the unhealthy thing I've been doing with her music, is over-focusing on the subject, on the muse, and not just enjoying it like I once did. I mean, because I once did, and it was fun that way. Like, I am to this day misty-eyed by the hearing the first few chords of Enchanted. It does not even cross my mind that that is about the dude who sung, and I get 1,000 hugs from 10,000 lightning bugs. That line invented the concept of the ick, but it doesn't take away from Enchanted whatsoever. It made me realize that there maybe is a problem with how I engage with her music experientially, and how it's changed for the worse over the years. Like, I want to be able to appreciate it for what it is lyrically, melodically. And I just hate that somewhere along the way, the subject of the song became so distracting it affects my affinity toward it. Okay, what actually brings me to another point. People are kind of shocked at the volume of alleged Maddie Healy references and kind of aghast that this album can be orbiting their seemingly far more brief recent fling rather than her six-year relationship with Joe. But, like, we have to remember, she wrote a love song for the ages that still makes me misty-eyed to this day about meeting the lead singer of Owl City quite literally in passing. So, yeah, I think she can write a full anthology about a fortnight. You know, when did he hold her lifeless frame? After 3 months in the grave. Like, some of her best stuff is not from her longest relationships. And here at the Be There in Five podcast, we don't focus on if we think your reaction is proportionate to the length you dated or your level of involvement. Your response is your response. And millennial women have lived a long life of being told they're too dramatic or too emotional or they're overreacting. We get admonished for lacking perspective as if it's not a function of youth. And there's something kind of awesome about being like told you need to grow up and then growing up and realizing how shitty it is to treat somebody's emotional response as a toddler's tantrum. Oh, shit. Speaking of toddler, I have a child. Okay. Be right back after these brief messages. My life source during these trying times when I'm trying to stay up all night to talk about a Taylor Swift album that I've barely even had time to listen to but desperately want to talk about with all of you is, of course, Liquid IV. The way I get so dehydrated talking, or Kelly and I did with Patreon, and we would just chug a crisp, cold glass of Liquid IV. I think for me, my latest flavor du jour, I'm into the pear and the sugar-free white peach. Liquid IV is for everybody. I think there's ordinary things we all do that bring us extraordinary joys. And it doesn't matter if you're like before or after a workout. It's like a perfect poolside companion or just a great way to stay hydrated while you're traveling. I always drink it on planes. During the summer, we can get dehydrated quite easily. And one of the reasons I love it is because I know a lot of you love to just, you know, carry around a 40-ouncer, but I can't be bothered to slosh around like that. I don't want to drink that much water, but I do want the hydration. And one stick of Liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates better than water alone. It's kind of like a BOGO, a two-for-one in terms of hydration. There's three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink. That's, you know, no wonder it's the number one powdered hydration brand in America. With 8 vitamins and nutrients, non-GMO and free from gluten, dairy, and soy. And 4 delicious sugar-free flavors, white peach, green grape, raspberry, melon, and lemon lime. And it's a zero sugar hydration solution with no artificial sweeteners. Clinically tested to hydrate more than water alone. Turn your ordinary water into extraordinary hydration with Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com and use code BETHEREIN5 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code BETHEREIN5 at liquidiv.com. I've been telling you guys recently that my skincare routine is like hugely simplified, and now I'm very into body care, and I'm obsessed with Osea. Anybody that uses it is. It's so legit. I've been working with them forever, and I hope that they'll advertise forever because it's just a product I stand by through and through. A consistent body care routine, giving your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven seaweed-infused skincare, like genuinely provides results, and you guys will be obsessed with it if you try it. And right now you can get 10% off your first order with our code BETHEREIN5 at Osea Malibu. The Andaria Algae Body Oil is like TikTok viral and so many people talk about it, but I'll never stop sharing that I put it on after the shower when I have the driest skin you have ever seen in your life. Like, getaway car desert levels. And I put on the body oil when I'm damp, and it literally keeps me so moisturized all day. And it kind of gives you that sheen that celebs have on the red carpet, that you look like you're literally glowing, illuminated, more silky and soft. And it just makes me feel like a new woman. And the Andaria Algae Body Butter is so thick and gorgeous too. That's what I like. That and the anti-aging body balm is what I like to mix with like a little bit of self-tanner drops. And the body butter is clinically proven to hydrate for 72 hours. The body butter, for example, is clinically proven to hydrate for 72 hours, which is nuts. And you know I would not use the word supple unless I meant it, but it does transform dry skin to soft, smooth, and supple. And they also have a moisture duo currently with two of Osea's bestsellers, the Andaria Algae Body Oil and the Collagen Body Lotion, infused with their signature seaweed to replenish your skin's moisture. And it's a great value because you can save 16% and then an additional 10%, could be there in 5. So glow from the inside out with clean vegan skin and body care from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code BETHEREIN5 at oseamalibu.com. You'll get free samples with every order and free shipping on orders over $60. Head to oseamalibu.com and use code BETHEREIN5 for 10% off.
I mean, there's a real Behind Bars theme. Not only Behind Bars opening with her being a functioning alcoholic, there's prisons, asylums, jails, mental health troubles. I still am unclear if the sterile environment is maybe a morgue. We're mixing a lot of metaphors. After hearing the Amy song in Cassandra, I'm like, oh, maybe that whole time that stale white building was just supposed to be Kim K's house. And it makes sense that, you know, Joe was like, he can be my jailer, burned to this tailor. They break up. She's what? Fresh out the slammer. I think a lot of the way she describes the relationship, like in the prologue, epilogue thing, like the way she describes out of the frying pan and into the fire is out of the oven and into the microwave. And I think that's our first hint that, like, most of the time, the songs are talking about them interchangeably. I think they both hurt her in a way that is similar. I think they were both the love of her life in different ways, both Lommels, and I think this song refers to both of them. But what's the difference between an oven and a microwave? The speed, the pace, but they yield the same result. At the end of the day, you're done. You're cooked. You're out. But two very different experiences that, like, rock you in different ways. They have the same function, but at different speeds. And I think that she experienced a tremendous amount of grief and heartbreak in one context of a more serious long-term relationship and another in, like, if we get burned, at least we work electrified type of style, except this is a person that she put, like, all of her hopes, dreams, expectations into in a period of, you know, as she says, a manic period of grief. And it just completely blew up in her face. And I just can't believe all this was happening while she was performing multiple Eras tours night after night, looking so happy. And it's just, wow. Yeah, I mean, she says, at one point you deserve prison, but you won't get time. I mean, I personally thought to myself, jail, immediately when I heard he brought a typewriter to her apartment, like, ugh, we get it, you're old timey. Like, go to a Six Flags, take one of those weird saloon photos. I don't know. People obsessed with bygone eras that like to make things challenging for themselves for sport as if it's somehow, like, noble or makes them more interesting. Like, I'm a nostalgic gal. I like to put myself back in the shoes of my younger self and draw connections. You don't see me out here writing my book on MS-DOS for sport. I don't know. He just bothers me on so many levels, but I also am not, like, a fan. I don't have context, so it's not, like, fun. I can't draw connections in the ways I can with other situations because I was kind of not aware that they had such a lengthy love affair. But I did print out, like, a 14-page PDF to get myself caught up. When it's kind of, like, a little unsettling, her, like, fuck the fan song, it's like, but daddy, I love him. But it kind of seems like eventually she came around and was like, oh, yeah, he does kind of suck. And now they've severed ties and closed that door. Somebody brought up on Patreon, I think her name was Christine, that she thinks the end of But Daddy, I Love Him is kind of that progression of, like, you know, this guy did this and this girl did that and now they're married and I'm their kid or whatever, you know, the country song storytelling. Somebody, yeah, I think she said that she thinks the end of But Daddy, I Love Him is with the twist ending of Now My Daddy Loves Him. Like, on the one hand, I think it could be a delusional fantasy of her thinking that. That could be possible. Or Christine was saying she thinks it could be a twist ending and, like, Travis came along and her daddy loves him. Also, lol, the being in your 30s and the word daddy, it kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies. I'm going through my notes. I also was wondering, like, you know how she says, and guilty as sin, I keep these longings locked in lowercase inside a vault. You know how Folklore and Evermore were all lowercase? I think we're now realizing that a lot of those songs were not fiction and it was a cover. But also, I was like, wait, is there something about Love of My Life and I'm Gonna Get You Back? They're the only lowercase titles on the album. So, you know, is that there's something with that lowercase in the vault that are, like, telling us something? I think that, okay, there's a handful of songs I love. Maybe I'll walk through those, walk through high level, like, what I'm gleaning from the internet and from reviews. I haven't even listened to all the songs yet. I know it's terrible. I'm having a hard time telling them apart. This always happens when we're in a sonically cohesive situation. Like, I kind of like my albums, like, I like a floor plan. I want it choppy as hell, and I want to get lost and nestle in its little pocket and not be disturbed by the outside world. But I'm here for the open floor plan, too. It just, everything kind of blends together. And I will say, I wonder if the next album might be, like, a time for a little bit more diversity in, like, the producer she works with. But I almost could see this album, too, like, this is so honest. I think it was meant to be controversial. I think it was meant to not be for everybody. And I don't know. It's kind of like her own cultural reset. Like, I part of me wonders if she did the Eras tour, all the hits, the bangers, the stadium songs, so on and so forth. And now she's just kind of like Beyonce, do exactly what she wants. And there's something really important about these incredibly powerful women completely rejecting convention that I think is important for like the music industry to just even from a data standpoint, prove that audiences crave more dynamic music than the formulaic earworms that are often demanded of the artists they exploit. And these two people are at a point in their career where they can't be. They're so powerful. And I love seeing people like do whatever the hell they want. And I think that's the most important thing you have to remember with this album, right? Is like, this is for her. This is catharsis. I think that songs like Lommel are about both of them. I think her muse is both of them. I think some songs are devoted to one. I think most interchange them because they abandoned her in different ways. Joe didn't physically abandon her, but emotionally, Maddie literally physically abandoned her. We thought it was going to be torture poets department was a postmortem of the relationship with Joe. What we got was a shocking number of songs about what on the surface seems like a brief fling and an almost disproportionate level of self-destruction relative to it. But I don't think that's the point. I think the point is, under the weight of grief, of mourning the loss of something great, not only are you not yourself, but you can almost be in a state of like shock and capitulation, denial. Like there's so many different emotions a person can go through. And I think we really don't always give ourselves the grace that while a breakup, you know, the person may still be alive, like you quite literally are severing your life from theirs in a quite permanent way that is excruciating, even if they're still walking this earth. And at times, that's the painful part, is like being strangers and still both walking this same earth and having nothing to do with one another. Some notable lyrics: when it's burn the bitch, they're shrieking. When the truth comes out, they're quiet. The second are the phantom secondhand embarrassed on the balcony. Whew, killed me. I think come one, come all, it's happening again from the second track, 5. What's it called? How it ends is like, it's that's what they say at a circus. Come on, come all. And, you know, the circus, as we know, made her mean. I also think like the idea of feverishly calling the cousins and stuff. We'll have to get into that one at a later date. White knuckle, dying grip, holding tight to your quiet resentment. Whew. Every day of a love affair, every breath feels like rarest air when you're not sure if he wants to be there. I didn't like sanctimoniously performing soliloquies because it reminded me of Thomas Ravenel at that dinner party at Patricia's house, being like, sanctimonious. Black Dog is stunning. Old Habits, Die Screaming. Amazing. Kelly and I were talking about on Patreon how people from the Northeast all have Black Dog shirts. People from the Southeast all have Salty Dog shirts from Hilton Head, Black Dog, Martha's Vineyard. People from like Mid-Atlantic all have Brew Through shirts. And like people from the Midwest, or like a lot of Michiganders have the Stray Dog t-shirts. What's with all the dogs? Well, and Brew Through. Brew Through was hilarious that I was wearing that in high school, now that I think about it, because I could not brew, nor could I through. Couldn't drive, couldn't drink. Don't know why a drive-through drinking place was my t-shirt of choice. But anyway, but this Black Dog is in London. And I think that song is so gut-wrenching because like the idea of still having somebody's look, it makes me want to die. Thinking about having somebody's location and wanting to know what they're up to. And then you see where they are and you like, I've done this worrying my sister or husband have been abducted when they were like on work trips. I can't imagine the stories I would write if I had lost contact with somebody, if I missed them, if I wonder what they were doing without me, if I wondered if they were with somebody new. I think the Alchemy is really cute. Kelly and I like really enjoyed listening to it. I need to re-listen to So High School later because I don't really remember much except for you like to ball. I know Aristotle, and I just was. She's having fun. She's back in high school. She's also in a depth of despair where she thinks somebody wanted her dead, and she wanted herself dead, and she was like crying at the gym. It's just a lot. It's a lot. but we can contain multitudes. The prophecy is also incredibly sad and one of many self-referential songs about her career. But like, she doesn't want money. She just wants someone to enjoy her company is like gut-wrenching. By the time I got to track 19, I was just like, huh? I was too distracted by I'm Gonna Get You Back. Like, I'm Gonna Get You Back is to Olivia Rodrigo's Get Him Back as No Strings Attached is to Friends with Benefits. It's almost confusing when two things exist in pop culture within a short time frame that have the identical concept. And it's hard to know who wrote what first versus what came out first, because obviously there's so much more that goes into these songs. It's not like she would have heard that a few months ago, then written a song in response to it. It's just, I would imagine it's a coincidence. Peter all but confirms Cardigan's probably about Maddie, right? I don't know what else. Anyway, so that's just like some of my high-level thoughts. The twist ending of Claire Bow, it's very like Last Great American Dynasty. People seem to love it. I think it was like interesting to hear her sing her own name. And I get her bigger point. It's almost kind of sad how the greats, Claire Bow, Stevie Nicks, like the It Girls are at once honored and kind of diminished in them becoming such household names like Kleenex, you know, where they're almost like the token name you use in that era to describe an It Girl or a pop star or a movie star. And there's a level of ubiquity there that I'd imagine is dehumanizing, where they're talked about themselves, the product, the star, not the person. And due to that, we don't always realize how, by always calling somebody new, the new blank, we're kind of verbally trying to retire them off, like they've served their purpose and need to be replaced as the new It Girl, even though it's kind of flattering that we're using them as an era's default It Girl. I don't know if that makes sense. But again, I don't think I think a lot of this stuff was really beautiful and I wasn't appreciating it at a certain level of volume. I don't know. I'm not at a place where I can be like, this is my, you know, in my top five favorite albums, or this is like, I don't know, I'm obsessed, it's a masterpiece, or like, I hate this. It's like, so I just want to focus on the positive. Those are like things that I like or I think are funny and are like slightly unhinged, but I think that's, she kind of wanted to be unhinged in this one. My friends all smell like weed or little babies. And it's like, well, while that's not, you know, there's no SAT words, it's not Dickinsonian. It's a very clever and condensed way to say in your 30s, it seems like suddenly everyone has kids or never left their 20s. Like everyone grew up or never grew up. And where does that leave you for somewhere in the middle? And like, I think that's Kelly and I were both like, oh, yeah, we get that. So it sometimes the simplest language can convey a point the best. And sometimes the complexity of language yields such little clarity of message, of tone, that I don't leave feeling educated as much as I leave feeling alienated, like I'm just not smart enough to be listening to this. But that's okay. Not everything's for me. And my thick skull is another person's light bulb moment. Everything's, you know, different things resonate with different people. When you take a step back, there's a story she's clearly telling that is autobiographical. And this is a paragraph I lifted from Vox because I was like, there's got to be a journalist that's already condensed this, because if I try to do a quick summary, I'll get lost. Saying, the Torture Poets Department sees its central character reeling from two breakups, one with a long-term lover whose depression had begun to drag the narrator down, like So Long London, and one a brief fling with a tortured bad boy who no one seemed to approve of, Fortnite. As the album goes on, the narrator veers between teenage infatuation with her new bad boy, like down bad, resentment with everyone who tells her they shouldn't be together, but daddy, I love him, the slow, grudging realization that perhaps there are some problems with the relationship, I can fix him, no really I can, and fury when he eventually leaves her, the smallest man who ever lived. The narrator's despair over her love for the lost, depressed boyfriend threads its way through the whole album. Love of My Life, The Black Dog. Actually, I don't know if I agree about Love of My Life. Sometimes the imagery associated with him ends up in a song about the bad boy like Fresh Out the Slammer, which ends on an ambivalent line about imaginary rings like an intrusive thought. At times, her heartbreak over both breakups is so intertwined it becomes impossible to tell who exactly she's singing about, like I Can Do It with a Broken Heart. And I was like, yeah, that hits the nail on the headstone of her mourning multiple things at once, the two relationships driving us crazy because we're trained to like paternity test, to like put, you know, assign a song to a person. But there were multiple things happening at once here. And a rebound by nature is a function of having just gotten out of something. So your thoughts and feelings recovering from a rebound can't really exist without the relationship that led into it. And it seemed like in a moment when she was rethinking her relationship with Joe, her and Maddie reconnected in some way. And in kind of making her believe he's finally available after what seems like a lot of years of ships passing and the timing never working out, I think she kind of, you know, jumped ship pretty quickly and got out of the Joe relationship in kind of that emotional moment, as she described in the epilogue or prologue. I can't really tell which it is because I don't have the physical album, but I'm pretty sure it's an epilogue. It says, in summation, it was not a love affair. I scream while bringing my fist to my coffee ring desk. It was a mutual manic phase. It was self-harm. It was house and then cardiac arrest. A smirk creeps onto this poet's face because it's the worst men that I write best. I mean, really, if you read the in summation prologue, like, it kind of, I just kept having to revisit it over and over because I think it really explains exactly what's going on. Yeah, maybe I'm off here, but I just, something about this album, I think the point is of sharing tortured poetry is like, she's a tortured person who wrestles with fame and mental health and who falls for shitty men and then whose reflex is to not always realize they're shitty, but be on and off and never go out of style and over romanticize their circumstances instead of see it for what they are. And then when people call her out on it, be like, no, fuck all y'all. I'm going to defend this shitty guy. And then maybe be like, oh yeah, I guess he does kind of suck. I mean, she opened the album referring to being a functioning alcoholic as her newest aesthetic that nobody noticed. Like, I think she's almost leveraging this high, not leveraging, but she sees an opportunity with this high status that this these lyrics convey the great limitations of, that I think she can afford to fall a little bit. I think she can afford to lose the favor and not have a smash hit album that sweeps everybody off their feet. Like, I think she can afford to experiment. Perhaps she sees that, you know, it's almost like you, the second you get too high, people wait for you to fall. Like, let me take myself down a couple notches. Like, I think being a flawed human was the goal of this album. I think she just wanted to emote and express herself and put this album out because the period of time when she looked the happiest, looked the best she's ever looked. Like, honestly, it did look like she was thriving on that tour. It's crazy to think that she went through two, like, earth-shattering, tumultuous heartbreaks in different ways. And we had no idea what was going on behind the scenes. And I like being let into that inner world because I just don't think anyone could ever imagine the pressure she's under and the frustration at having so much like fame and power and money, yet being so incredibly restricted on where she can go and what she can do with it. And theoretically, like, having all this freedom and being so beloved, but how maddening it would feel as a woman to have the public like demanding certain behaviors out of you, like you can't handle yourself and you don't know better. Anyway, she's out of the oven and into the microwave, but I left my first listen feeling like I, as a fan, was the one that got roasted because wow, 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 does she hate being famous? And I assume she hates people like me that analyze her work. So much of her tortured nature is less inherent than it is a function of the apparent asylum that this machine we fuel as fans has created for her. And I just have had a pit in my stomach ever since. I mean, we were frothing at the mouth for this post-breakup takedown, but we're the ones who got dragged. And I say that because I don't know. I feel like a lot of the podcast listeners out there who I affectionately call the Beths, not because of Beth March, but because of Be There in Five, the first four letters are Beth. You know, I said in One in a Millennial, in describing your good nature, that many of us self-identify as like, we love listening to I Knew You Were Trouble, but absolutely hate getting in trouble. And listening to But Daddy, I Love Him was like that feeling of being at a sorority chapter meeting, kind of hungover, and Standards expresses their disappointment in how our behavior like wasn't classy at the social last night with Pie Cap. And every basement grind, elevated surface danced upon, beer bong, you know, browned out conversation like flashes before my eyes, lights, camera, bitch, smile. And my face feels hot. And in a matter of like 15 seconds, even though I'll have done absolutely nothing wrong to my memory, I'll convince myself like this fucking play is about us and I'm the one to blame and assume that they must be talking about me, even though I literally could not tell you what I had done. Like, I'm just a person who thinks that if somebody is addressing a crowd and they're disappointed in you, I will internalize that as being about me. Call it narcissism. Call it hypersensitivity. Call it what you want. All I know is that there's something kind of like brilliant and diabolical about shaming her fans in her music, because it will absolutely get weaponized by superfans to further shame people with dissenting opinions going forward in a way that is both culty and effective. Not because that's her intent, but that's how like stan culture works. And I remember feeling like, oh, things have turned a corner. When, like, what did I say? Oh, just, I was like talking about on Instagram how I think it would have been like considerate for the ticket prices and the details of the VIP packages to release that before the Eras Tour lottery. I caught a DM that was like, ugh, how quickly we forget the voices that implore you should be doing more. We have to stop demanding so much of her. And I was like, okay, I'm just, are you really using sweet nothings against me right now? So yeah, I just am like, this is going to be interesting to see how this is leveraged. And I really like the song. It was just so fun to listen to for the first time. But also, I think that that's the first like blatant resentment she's really communicated for her fans, or her fans that act concerned for her as a person. But she's like, fuck you, I don't know you. I could talk about that song all day. But honestly, part of my concern is that there's going to be a camp of fans who assume it's just directed at the people being the most harsh or critical or writing open letters and trying to like control who she dates. And that's kind of why I made a cult joke earlier, because it's the most fascinating situation where she's kind of shaming people for being like caring too much and being too invested and overstepping their bounds, suggesting that the people that do that don't actually, you know, care at what vipers dressed in empaths clothing. But also in creating that sort of environment where sometimes these lyrics, even if it's not her intention, they serve as like thought terminating clapbacks to anybody that says anything negative in a way that I do not think is productive and creates a worse mob mentality. I don't think that that's her fault or something she can necessarily handle through lyricism, but it is something we have to watch out for, that like the internet culture of today and stan culture and Mother Swiftie 2.0, like the dehumanizing pedestal of just like protecting her at all costs is, I don't know. I mean, Paste Magazine released a review anonymously, citing it was safer to release it with no byline attached because they were concerned about the safety of their staff following a review that had criticisms in it in like 2019 of Lover and how the fans bullied and doxed the writer. Guys, that's insane. I think that defending her that hard is just as bizarre as writing her an open letter. And trust me when I say, I do not think the contents of the open, I think people have every right to be offended by a man, especially if he continuously has insulted or said something offensive about a group or community you're a part of, and then people act like you're crazy and you're not deep enough to understand his performance art. I remember feeling like the open letter was a little far, and not, but again, it's not like the sentiment, that was all valid. It's just that I don't feel like that was the appropriate course of action. I think it's infantilizing to send a grown woman a letter trying to control who she dates and what she does, when she should, you know, she should just make her own choices. And then we have to decide as fans how we approach a person who makes those choices. You know what I mean? Like, I want you to want to do the dishes. Speaking of breakups, I don't want to force you to do the dishes so I can trick myself into there being sincerity because I want to continue to support you so badly. So like, I don't think that was the move. I don't think that was the way to get to her. And I think that it's pretty clear that that really pissed her off. I assume that's what she's talking about. But she could just be talking about people in general. I'm sorry, I'm all over the place. I mentioned Florida, but like, can we just, I don't know how you guys feel about Florida. I haven't gotten a consensus, but I'm on board. I'm on the cruise ship. And I can't quite explain this, but to me, very few of the songs hold a candle to the new anthem of the panhandle. I'm not totally sure how I feel about Taylor and Maddie as a pair, but I know that I feel pretty great about me and my pair eyewear as a pair. Great segue. If you watch the Patreon reaction video, you know, all casual 2 hours of it, I was wearing a pair of glasses that made me feel like, that just brought out the tortured poet in me. It was the frame style, the Murphy in black. And I also have the Kirby and the Reese, but the Murphy is like a fashion-y big lens that I'm just so obsessed with right now. And Pair Eyewear is the best because you get infinite possibilities and they start at just $60, including your prescription. And with their Suntop collection, you can protect your eyes in style without paying extra for prescription sunglasses. And you can get 15% off using code BTIF at PairEyewear.com. So there's that. But literally, the Suntops are so fun to snap on. I've showed you on Instagram before. You have your prescription glasses you normally wear, and then you just have a sun top that's like snaps on, and you can't even tell they're not part of the glasses. Like, it doesn't look goofy like those 90s flip up frames. It actually just, they look like expensive prescription sunglasses. And I love that I just carry my one pair of eyeglasses around, and then I have a topper that's a sunglass, and I don't have to carry prescription sunglasses in addition to regular sunglasses when I have my contacts in. Really, it's space saving and efficient. And I love that you can change up your frame and snap on a different style. You can snap on a blue light filter. They have base frames for men and women and kids starting at $60. And then the Suntop frames start at just $30. And there's like endless versatility. They're incredibly durable. There's wide frames to fit every face. You can use pre-tax FSA and HSA dollars. And I cannot recommend this more for your kids that might be getting glasses or have glasses, because they can express themselves with all sorts of cute toppers, whether it's like Barbie or Marvel or colors or sparkles or holidays. And I just think it's a really cool company. And I also love that they were on Shark Tank, and I'm happy to see them thriving. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code BTIF for 15% off your first pair. And support the show by mentioning that Be There in 5 sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code BTIF. And if you want my Patreon glasses, they're called the Murphy. $60, can't beat it. This episode is brought to you by ButcherBox. My sister's in town, and I don't always, you know, make my house guests cook for me, but my sister's a good cook, and thank God I have a reserve of organic seafood and beef and chicken in my freezer, because we're just kind of whipping up recipes that we see on TikTok for kicks, and I'm having a great time. Otherwise, I would not be bothered to go to the store, but that's why I love ButcherBox. You can easily find high-quality meat and seafood you can trust with 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. And it's delivered right to your doorstep, free shipping. And you can either get a curated box that the ButcherBox team has put together or customize your own. It's just kind of an incredible value. When you see words like grass-fed or free-range or organic, there's such a markup in the grocery store, and it's hard to know what's what and if you can actually trust or know where anything's from. And ButcherBox prioritizes working with quality suppliers to get premium cuts, but distributes them in a way that enables you to get a really good deal. And I just am here for the less trips to the grocery store and to be prepared on the fly to have a meal. And you can also get curated tips and recipes based on your box. I think this is honestly such a good gift for like your parents, for Mother's Day, Father's Day, a birthday, a dude who loves to grill, people like aging parents, people going through a surgery, going through a tough time, just had a baby. Like as a recent new mom, it's nice to see getting all the receiving blankets was. I think a box of meat is maybe more what the doctor ordered. Needed the iron, didn't feel like leaving the house. I don't know. I think people overlook this as a gift option. But anyway, today ButcherBox is giving our listeners a special offer. Use my link, butcherbox.com/betherein5, and use code betherein5 to get $20 off your first order. That's butcherbox.com/betherein5 and code betherein5. And as always, we'll put the links on the Be There in 5 podcast Instagram and on my website and in the show notes. All right. Back to the episode. It's basically a Florence and the Machine song with Taylor Swift in it. So maybe that's why I'm drawn to it. And hearing her explain it, which I'll play for you, helped me realize, oh, this is kind of an interesting concept. And the fact that someday we may be in a stadium singing Fuck Me Up Florida is just one of the funniest things ever. And I think I was just too excited because my predictions are always so gravely wrong. But in the fake parody song I wrote, imagining what Florida will be like, one of the only lines was, they say home is where the heart is, but God, I love Destin. You know, I love a Florida boy. I enjoy Daytona, NASCAR in the afternoon. Took me back to Boca, hang out with the locals. And there's no income tax to boot. You know, I love a Florida boy. And so when we got to the part where she's talking about a timeshare in Destin, I was like, what alternate universe are we in right now? But I don't hate it because most of us wouldn't be just like Leo in Saint-Tropez. Most of us are a little more sandals than Saint-Tropez. And I don't know, this album did not take me to the lake, so I guess the next best thing is the Gulf. And I honestly, like, have maybe listened to Florida the most, besides I Can Do It With a Broken Heart.
And I just didn't see that coming.
But yeah, I saw absolutely none of this coming, to be clear. I think people are assuming it's a function of disorganization and self-indulgence, but I think it's kind of a creative risk that she's able to take right now. I don't know, like early in your career when you're trying to establish yourself, you kind of fall into the trap she discussed in Miss Americana, you know, that the whole concept of nothing new, the exhausting nature as a female artist to constantly have to reinvent yourself to stay relevant, to gain popularity, to use an appropriate theme for this album, to be an it girl. And per the Fortnite video, it's almost like she wiped the Clara Bow off and revealed the real her via, you know, metaphorical face tattoos. I think this is maniacal, convoluted writing she does behind the scenes that for once she like wanted to put out there. Maybe she kind of isn't really feeling comfortable with where her image is. Actually, that's pretty, it's almost abundantly clear that she is now like grappling with the limits of her being at the absolute apex, at like the highest status. I don't know what's worse, that or her castle crumbling overnight. But a lot of songs allude to like the perils of being held to a high standard, you know, the bitching and moaning, the people that want to know how it ended, the crowd screaming more. Like so many songs allude to her discontentment with the public's like engagement and interest in her and yeah, kind of the downfalls of having such a positive image. And it's almost interesting, where unlike Reputation, which is like, my reputation's never been worse, you must like me for me. This is almost like, my reputation's never been better, but you don't like me for me. You don't know me at all. And I think taking off her like it girl mask for the Fortnite video is an interesting metaphor. And maybe in this status that so few have ever achieved in terms of, I mean, like, just let's look at where she is right now. Like, she is the highest grossing music tour of all time. You know, not everybody has positive sentiments toward this, but I would imagine she does. She was recently declared officially a billionaire. Midnight's won album of the year. She is solo artist with the most wins of all time in that category. She is in the most highly publicized and, you know, seemingly beloved rom-com of a relationship with an NFL football player. That if you listen to Patreon, it's also devastatingly handsome and charming in person. By and large, she does not get the hate she once did. Like, even all the enemies she used to sing about, I don't really like feel like formally exist. The worst thing that's probably happened to her in recent years was the sale of her masters. But she's, you know, eclipsed those original recordings with her re-recordings and has done such a good job reclaiming what's hers. And I mean, like, could a person on paper be more objectively at the top of the world? And what do we constantly learn about fame, fortune, societal prominence is sometimes people in these circumstances are the most stuck, the most caged, the most depressed, and often unable to express it without being misunderstood or dismissed as being too privileged to have permission to have those feelings, or you know what I mean? And I think that for the first time, she isn't editing on purpose because she's not curating an experience for us. I think like my biggest takeaway with this album is this album is for her. She's making art for herself. She doesn't have to obsess over its commercial viability. She's broken every record there is to be broken. Where do you go from here? Maybe you just have fun. Maybe you just artistically explore. Like when you're younger, you try on different versions of yourself as a form of discovery. But in your 30s, self-discovery becomes more about accepting who you always were than finding somebody else you're supposed to be. And I'm kind of laughing at reviews that are citing her lack of maturity or like redundance of themes or, you know, she should have her life figured out by now. Could she really still be singing about this stuff? And it's like, these people aren't who this is for, A. Because B, if they were, like, is there anything more relatable than growing older but none the wiser? Like, maturity is no longer performing wisdom that's not there. It's being honest about the messiness of life. It's choosing to no longer be so, like, withholding and calculated for self-preservation, because all of that effort is not rooted in self-expression. It's rooted in trying to manage others' perceptions of you. I think she's experimenting. I think she's taking a risk. I think she started writing this album thinking she was in a club with Maddie and they were like the tortured poets department. But that was kind of a mask too of denial, because in the Fortnite video, when she's with Post during certain times when they're typing across from each other, she's in that like black Victorian dress and she doesn't have tattoos, nor does Post Malone, which he looks very handsome, by the way. And then in other parts, they both have tattoos. When she's in the asylum, she wipes off the Clarabelle It Girl face and has it. I don't know. There's something there. So the Fortnite music video, it's the song I've probably one of my least favorite first listens. I didn't understand it. It was so loaded with metaphor. I just found it confusing. It doesn't really build, but like it's one of those songs, the more I heard it, the more I started swaying, the more I started tapping my feet. It was in my head. It sounds like I can see you. Post Malone is kind of hot without the face tats in the video. And like, I thought, honestly, the music video, I was like, oh yeah, doesn't Maddie like wear lab coats? I don't know. But obviously I think it was like deeper and more complicated than that. So she's like in her Grammys dress, right? Chained to an empty bed frame in an asylum. I can only assume we tie that to the end of Hits Different when, is that you or have they come to take me away? And then they forgot to get her at the beginning of this album. And she can unchain herself from this asylum if she takes a forget him pill. And she gets electrocuted, but her partner, played by Post Malone, unplugs the power and saves her. And she's in a Victorian morning dress, but without a tattooed face again. And he doesn't have a tattooed face. She's mourning for her previous relationship, but falls for this guy. And they're typing on typewriters. And this is where I think her and Maddie had, like, they started out kind of jokingly having this shared tortured poets department. Hence my obsession with the apostrophe, because there was two poets in it, I think. Then she, you know, wipes herself again and still has the tattoo on her face in the fall of the relationship, you know, that the papers burn. And then she breaks the mirror and realizes like she's in the back in the exact same place. I don't know if we're playing on like the fucked in the head thing or what. I mean, Kelly and I are pretty convinced that Maddie and Taylor are subject of illicit affairs now. You show me colors, you know, I can't see with anybody else. Isn't Halsey's colors about him, or is that about... No, maybe I'm getting confused. Halsey wrote like a whole album about this guy. Don't get it, but he's got a hold over some people. When they're writing each other the typewriter letters, it's like the colors are, it's kind of like them writing the fiction, maybe the manuscript, I don't know, even though the manuscript I don't think is about this, of their love story, like all these dreams and plans and, you know, if he put a ring on her, you know, wedding band finger and her heart almost exploded. I mean... But Daddy, I Love Him. It's and like Who's Afraid of Little Old Me? It kind of just seems like people were afraid of what she would do in this state of like grief and afraid of what Maddie would do to her image. And I assume that's like the shock therapy of it all. There's a very obvious black dog in this scene. I think Love of My Life, it's kind of like, which I keep saying Lommel, is kind of like they both honestly could have been and were in different ways. That's kind of the irony of Love of My Life. It's less of a soulmates thing and more so that there can be very important, earth-shattering loves of your life that will always be losses of your life. I thought it was interesting in the Fortnite music video that they were inside of her head, like the Style music video, but didn't they, her and Style was written before she and Maddie even like met. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I'm surprisingly not that interested in the Artifact songs. Except for the black dog. Kelly and I were pretty bored during the Bolter, and the albatross was a little hard for me to understand. So again, these are things I need to revisit. Maddie might have been a catalyst for her jumping out of a 6-year relationship kind of fast. And imagine how pissed you would be if you ended your long-term relationship kind of suddenly for a guy who like love bombed you and like gave you the energy, excitement, enthusiasm to think that like, this was the right thing and gave you the strength to do it. And like you misread the situation for something it wasn't. And then he just completely ghosted you. And then you're left having to mourn both situations because the rebound was a band-aid that didn't fix the bullet hole of your longer term relationship. And you also didn't realize that you fantasizing and always wondering. I think it's clear now that Maddie's the one who haunted all of her what ifs, much to my disdain. Anyways, I think that's the broad story we're dealing with. And again, this is not necessarily right. I'm no authority. Another lyric I love, I'm a modern idiot, so don't listen to me. But this is just what I'm gleaning by having listened, talked to Kelly, and done like a minimal skim of critical reviews that, to my surprise, were more scathing than I thought they'd be. I think that they're kind of missing the mark for what it is. And again, I think criticism is fair and valid too. Like they're allowed to not like the album. That's totally fine. I just think they're maybe framing this as one of her past more commercial tightened up ventures. And I don't think that's what this is by design. I mean, the metaphor of her veins of pitch black ink, what she's saying is writing is her life source and she needs to like write to survive, but at the expense of like having to cut herself open to let the ink flow. And I think she like really did that this time without overthinking it. And it's, to me, it's less like, do I think the album's good or not? Do I like it or not? And more about like, I think it is what it's supposed to be. And I think it's the art she wanted to make. At this juncture, what I will say is good for her for taking that risk, because it's not easy to make art that doesn't pander to the audience in a world that increasingly demands what we consume must cater to our specific needs to be allowed to exist. But my takeaway is like, it's honest and it's sad and it's, you know, beautiful and delusional and self-aware and at times complex and frustrating and a bit exhausting, but like, so is life. And yeah, I'm here for like messy women in a sense of being like true anti-heroes. They're complicated. Not everything's tied up with a bow. I mean, I think I brought up Fleabag with her last album. I don't remember why. Oh, probably in the context of anti-hero, because I think she's just such a well-written anti-hero you like really root for despite being incredibly flawed. And I just think, yeah, people are better off. Like when she was young, the right thing to do probably felt like the pedestal, the good girl, the role model, et cetera. And she still like is all those things, but she's also like a grown up now. And this is a very edgy album. And it also feels kind of deeply not a stadium album. So I think it coming out now kind of also makes sense for her to be experimenting. Though I do think like, I'll die if I don't hear I Can Do It With a Broken Heart. That song is going to be so important for generations to come. It's so important for sensitive gals who self-worth lies in their productivity, like I said, and who are going to show up and stand out and put a huge smile on their face no matter what, because they value committing. And I just think a lot of people are like this, and a lot of people suffer behind the smile. And even though, you know, we shouldn't be walking in stilettos for miles, we'd feel worse if we didn't go. We Can Do It With a Broken Heart. And I think it applies to so many things, not just breakups. I think of every, you know, think of baby showers. You smile your way through when you're having fertility issues or experience loss. Think of friends' weddings. You know, you buy the gifts and the flights and you show up with a smile on your face when you're life becomes about celebrating other people's milestones. And then while you're at those milestones, all people do is ask you about your lack of milestones, as if you should have a simplified answer, or if you should be defined by who you're dating or how many babies you're having or whatever the hell else we're reduced to. Like, there's so many things we can't control in our life that mean our heart is often breaking into a million pieces in different ways for different things we always thought we'd wanted, or our life is diverted from our expectations and we have to smile through it and we can't complain about it because it is what it is. And I just hope we all can like scream, sing, cry, and heal to this song. I just am so obsessed with it. The only other thing I was going to say for today, I feel a little confused by the mixing of metaphors. Like, sometimes I thought it was academia. You know, she was a provost or something. Like Lorelai Gilmore, I don't know what a provost is. But she, admissions, I think, right? I was like, okay, she's like a department chair. This is something, she's like defending her PhD. But then I was like, oh no, this is evidence. This is a trial. And then when I read the prologue epilogue thing, I was like, oh, okay, yeah. I think this is a concept album where she was on trial with the public for being with Maddie. And this is her formal defense and being like, this is how crazy and delusional I was while it was happening. And I ultimately agreed that he does suck, but also you can't tell me what to do. And also, like, this is kind of a three-part series of, like, a broken heart, a fast rebound, bad decisions, a momentary lapse of judgment, like, a happy ending for now, where we watch American Pie and your friends play Grand Theft Auto and I make, you know, sonic allusions to doing hand stuff under a blanket. You know, I don't want your friends to hear my sighs. I actually like that song a lot. It was really cute. That's not meant to be. That's Glitter Gel Pen. I don't think that's meant to be that taken that seriously. But Taylor Swift didn't have the high school experience. Like, I think she's living it through Travis, and he's like the like babe of a jock. It's like obsessed with her, and they're like giddy and having fun on the surface. And you know, like I get what she's saying, and I think it's cute. It is funny how the alchemy almost has lines that resemble Travi at the game. But I also, Kelly and I both had goosebumps when he walked straight to her, not the trophy. I was moved. I can't fight the alchemy either. I kind of still think this is like, she decided that she wanted to do this sort of on trial with the public type thing and do a formal defense as a concept. And I haven't quite fleshed that out, but the way that summation is written, it just seems like, hi, I know this happened. Here's my formal defense. I plead insanity because of my lack of humanity. This chapter is over. Case is closed. Don't go after him. I'm done. I've moved on. But here is a moment in time. And this is my story. Law and Order. I don't watch Law and Order. Can you tell? This is Law Without Order, really. I don't know what this album was, but I am having a great time. I hope you are too. And I can't wait to hear your thoughts. And maybe we'll do a deeper dive at a later date. Maybe I'll feel inspired to look into certain parts of it. I can't decide. But regardless, I think the more this conversation was probably a little bit boring, but the fun thing is on patreon.com/bethereinfive. Promise it's worth the pledge. Not only do you get my tea about Sonia, meeting Travis, you also get 4 videos of me and Kelly just having goosebumps and being like, what the hell is going on? And hearing Charlie Puth in a song and not knowing what to do about it. I love you guys on Patreon. The comments were so fun. We loved interacting with you over this weekend, or maybe in our heads because we read them all and then talk to each other, but I'm not sure if we ever responded and we're, you know, monsters in that way. But love you regardless. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, come back. We talk about Taylor Swift all the time. We talk about lots of fun stuff all the time. Actually, 3 weeks ago, I did an Under the Influencer episode with Cassie from Blogilates because she's a podcast listener. And I wanted to interview her about her story and her business, PopFlex. And she sends me a bunch of the clothes and I wear them all the time. And I think they're great. And I think she has a really interesting process she shows everybody. Anyway, Taylor posted a reel of her wearing her like lilac tennis skirt, pickleball tulle skirt that's now like sold out and her business is booming. And we've been texting. And I'm just so pumped for her. And it's kind of funny timing because a lot of you are like, oh, pop, like, I think you've heard about PopFlex through this podcast if you already hadn't. It's a huge business. She doesn't need me. But it's kind of just kind of cool timing that you guys have context for like her story and how she got started and how much thought she puts into everything she does. And I love that Taylor's like out here looking for, you know, not the biggest head honchos of the athleisure world to support, but is supporting Cassie. And I just think that's so cool. Anyway, I don't know if I have any more to say. I'm sure I've forgotten everything, but it's Sunday and I have to watch my child. I'm kidding. He's not alone. He's with my husband and my sister, but they need a break because I've been gone all weekend doing this stuff. But love you. Talk to you soon. As always, let me know your thoughts and I'll let you know mine. I'll be there in 5. I swear.